from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Tonight, President George Bush and Senator John Kerry take the stage for the third and final presidential debate. The economy is at the top of a domestic agenda as the candidates spar over who has the better plan for health care, job creation, the deficit, and growth. Bush is pushing tax cuts and the ownership society. Kerry is arguing for tax redistribution and a break on outsourcing. We'll talk with two top economists this hour about what the candidates' quite different plans would mean for the economy and for you. And later in the hour, we'll get an economic reality check with on-the-ground reports from across the country, Silicon Valley, the Rust Belt, and Wall Street. Tonight on Point, Bush, Kerry, and the U.S. economy. Joining me now from Washington is Greg Ip, economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Greg, thanks for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
We've been talking right through much of George Bush's administration. Now his first term is coming to an end. There's a context for the debate tonight, for the campaigning around the economy. What can George Bush claim and what can't he claim for the economy that he's overseen, Greg?
Well, Tom, there's a couple of things in Bush's favor. First of all, from the standpoint of growth, by which we mean gross domestic product, it's actually been a pretty good term. If you look at just the last year, GDP growth has averaged about 5%. That's a tremendous performance by any standard. And if you look at the recession that happened under his watch, the truth is that the factors that drove us into recession probably did precede him being sworn in as president. And the truth is that the recession was, by historic standards, a mild one and a short one. And virtually all economists agree that the big tax cuts that we had in 2001 and 2003 mitigated the impact of that downturn. Now, on the negative side of the ledger, there's a few strikes against him as well. Even though we've had the economic growth, that has not translated into a lot of jobs. As we have heard many, many times, it appears that Bush is facing the electorate with fewer payroll jobs than when he took office, which would be the first time any president has done so since Herbert Hoover. And job growth in the last few months has actually been quite sluggish after a fairly strong spring. And I think that's showing up in terms of the nervousness of people. And it's probably the result of lingering nervousness, I think, in the business sector about hiring. They're still somewhat gun-shy after having been through the corporate scandals of the last few years and lingering concerns about Iraq, terrorism, and the very high price of oil.
Greg, can you look at how President Bush has managed the economy and say, well, this didn't create so many jobs. Is there some way in which the tax cuts were aimed elsewhere at investment in equipment or, I don't know, at outsourcing jobs? Is there something about the very structure of the Bush economic approach that augured against job creation?
Yeah, I think that some economists will make that point, Tom. In fact, the Bush tax cut did tend to disproportionately benefit those who save and those who invest, and those happen to be the rich because they've got the extra money to save and to invest. Now, in fairness, in the very long run, if we have higher investment, then that should make us more productive, and if we're more productive, we'll get paid more. But in the short run, it does mean that the rich had more money in their pockets, and they were less likely to go out and spend that right away, and that therefore had less of a short-term impact on economic growth than if the same number of dollars had been directed at the lower end of the middle class or alternatively have been spent outright, either by the federal government or by, for example, giving it to the state and local governments.
Now, the Dow back down almost at 10,000 again today, oil up again today, record price levels there. And you're reporting in your most recent story in the Wall Street Journal, Greg, economists saying the private sector is not all that confident right now. I mean, things have happened, yes, but George Bush has had 4 years. At some point, doesn't he have to take a more personal responsibility?
Tom, people will argue at length about how much impact presidents can have on the economy. It's very difficult to say. Could the fact of the matter is a lot of what we've been experiencing the last 3 or 4 years reflect, number one, things that happened in the 1990s. We had a very strong boom in investment and hiring going into the turn of the century. And the fact of the matter is that since the stock market bubble burst, companies have found that they've been able to do a lot of their selling and production without hiring and investing a lot more. So that's one of the legacies we're dealing with. Secondly, it's true that the current president's policies have arguably had some negative impacts on growth and job creation. But perhaps what's interesting here is that the policies that have had the biggest effect haven't been his economic policies, but his foreign policies. By invading Iraq, whatever the foreign policy merits, and people will argue at length about those, but the point is that by invading Iraq, he has created an additional level of uncertainty and tensions, which we see in the very high price of oil. So that also has to be playing a role here.
And what about the looming presidential election itself, Greg? Is that factoring in now to stock market prices, to somehow to economic growth itself? How do you see the economy factoring in this fork in the road, one direction Bush, the other John Kerry?
There is some evidence that, at least in certain sectors, stock investors are reacting differently to the two candidates. For example, there's not much debate that Kerry will take a tougher line with the drug companies and the HMOs and the energy companies than Bush would. And so that's a kind of a net negative for their stock prices. But I think the bigger story, really, that's affecting the overall stock market is just the continued uncertainty about the economic outlook, which, again, Tom, takes us back to the problems with oil and the fact that payroll job growth, as we've discussed, is also weak.
And what happens, finally, Greg, if that job creation just doesn't turn around? As you've said many times, this economy requires 150,000, maybe 200,000 new jobs a month just to keep up with its own expansion. It's been well short of that again recently. How long can that go on? What are the consequences?
I think, Tom, the problem that we have to confront is whether the consumers have basically been artificially stimulated to spend for the last 2 or 3 years through these repeated tax cuts and lower mortgage rates, and that now that the stimulus has basically run dry, they just can't spend anymore. And that means the only way to get more spending, really, is for them to have higher wages or more jobs. So if we don't get the increased employment and we don't get the increased wages, then consumer spending is going to stagnate further. And that suggests that the very strong growth we've had for the last year or two could fade on us.
Greg, thanks a lot for joining us tonight. Thanks for your check-in.
Sure thing, Tom.
Greg Ipp is economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Washington. We are talking tonight about the Bush and Kerry plans for the U.S. economy over the next 4 years. You can join this conversation. Who do you trust to do a better job with the economy from 2004 to 2008? What do you think of the Bush record? What do you think of the Kerry roadmap? Who's got the formula, short-term, long-term, for prosperity? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Princeton, New Jersey, is Alan Blinder, professor of economics and co-director of the Center for Economic Policy Studies at Princeton University. He was vice chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System from June 94 to January 96, and the member of President Bill Clinton's original Council of Economic Advisers from January 93 to June 94. He is an advisor to the Kerry campaign. We're delighted to have him. Alan Blinder, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Good evening, Tom.
Also joining us tonight from Rome, as in Italy, as in the Roman Empire, is Charles Calamaris, professor of finance and economics at Columbia University, a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and a backer of George Bush in the 2004 campaign. Charles Calamaris, thanks so much for joining us from sunny Italy tonight.
A pleasure.
Charles Calamaris, let me turn first to you, if I may. George Bush is the incumbent. He's looking to be reelected as an economist. Why are you supporting George Bush?
Well, of course, as an economist, I look at more than just the economy. But looking just at the economy, I think the president's record is quite good. I listened to what Greg said earlier, and I agreed with most of it. But I think the analysis that he'd made and many people make of the jobs record of the administration is actually not quite right. So I would say that we have right in the middle of a very favorable expansion, a very solid and I would say reliable expansion, and I think the president's policies have had a lot to do with it.
And your argument with the job depiction there?
Well, there are basically three problems with the analysis that Greg made. The first one is when you're looking at the job situation, you have to compare it to comparable experiences that we've had at this phase of the business cycle. Obviously, you wouldn't compare the current job situation to the previous peak in 2000. You'd want to compare it to a year more like 1995 or maybe even 1996, the end of the first Clinton administration. And the question is there any measure by which the current job situation is worse than it was in 1996? The answer is no. So if you look at it in terms of where we are in this phase of the business cycle, whether you look at the unemployment rate, whether you look at workers holding multiple jobs, workers who complain that they're doing part-time work because they couldn't find full-time work, whether you look at really just about any measure that you might want to look at, we are doing better in 2004 than we were in 1996. But there are two other reasons that the typical analysis of the jobs market is incorrect.
Okay.
One of them is, as Greg Mankiw, the Harvard professor who's now the chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, likes to point out, we had an extremely unusual and positive productivity growth experience even during the recession. And what that means is that for the same level of GDP growth, you need fewer workers.
Right.
And so during the recovery and now the expansion that we've been in, and I want to note that, we're not in a recovery. We've been in an expansion since early 2002. Mm-hmm. And since we had so much productivity growth and we're continuing to have productivity growth, the transition to a much higher employment level is going to take a little bit longer, but it is happening. Furthermore, other signs, workers' compensation has also really started to accelerate and has been growing at a very healthy rate. And so I think what we're seeing right now, again, considering the phase of the business cycle and considering the very unusually high productivity growth we've had even during the recession, is a very positive job picture. And the third point, of course, which people talk quite a lot about, is that we're having an unprecedented disagreement between two different measures of the labor market right now.
Right.
The establishment survey and the household survey. We just had an adjustment this past week, adding 250,000 jobs to the establishment survey numbers, trying to bring them a little closer.
Right. Two different measures and no agreement on those. On take-home pay, I have to say I'm confused. We'll come back to it, but I'm reading here today that take-home pay as a share of the economy has fallen to its lowest level since 1929 when the government started keeping records. But let's hold that thought and where George Bush goes next. I want to turn to Alan Blinder in Princeton, New Jersey. Alan Blinder, let me put the same question to you, again, narrowly here. As an economist, why are you supporting John Kerry for the presidency?
Yeah, well, there are so many reasons I hardly know where to begin, but I think I'd like to begin where you left off, which is the claim that wages are doing well in this economy. That either they've done well over the last 4 years or they're doing well of late is very much at variance with the fact. As you correctly pointed out, the share of the national pie, so to speak, going to workers is at the lowest since we've been collecting the data. The data only go back to 1929. It may be the lowest since past 1929. The recent performance of wages that Charles pointed to, he said he was careful. He said compensation, and mm-hmm. he's correct. Mm-hmm. It's not coming from wages. It's coming from health care, from benefits, which are dominated by health care costs, which, of course, are skyrocketing. Mm-hmm. So workers are actually getting less good health care coverage than the health insurance coverage than they used to, but it costs a tremendous amount of money. So, I mean, what's really happened? We have a quite weak job market despite the comparatively low unemployment rate. As you alluded to before, the job creation record of this administration is extremely poor, the worst since Hoover. The last year has been extremely mediocre. And that's what the president is bragging about. Let me try to put that into some perspective.
Okay.
If you did a rack up of the job creation in the 8 years of the Clinton administration and the 4 years of the Bush administration,
right,
the first eight would be all eight Clinton years, and the last four would be all eight Bush years, including the last year, which would be in ninth place. It's the best of the four Bush years.
In other words, if you rank them top to bottom, the Clinton years dominate the top, but the Bush people say, look, you had to dig out of a hole, and he's got a solid expansion now.
Yeah. Now, on the hole and the solid expansion, glad you asked again. Charles mentioned very correctly, or maybe it was Greg, that the hole we had to dig out of, that is the recession in 2001, was extremely mild, about the mildest in history.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't go very far downhill after, and in fact, after 9/11, the economy started going uphill again, though at a slow rate. It's now 3 years plus after 9/11, and the notion that we can still attribute the state of the economy to what happened on that horrible day is beginning to wear thin.
Alan Blinder of Princeton, Charles Calamaris of Columbia, stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We'll be back. There's a lot more we want to hear. We're talking tonight about Bush, Kerry, and the U.S. economy. We'll hear later in this hour from Silicon Valley, from the Industrial Belt in Ohio, from Wall Street. You can join us tonight. Who do you trust to do a better job with the U.S. economy 2004 to 2008? What do you think of the Bush record? What do you think of the Kerry plans? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight in advance of the third and final presidential debate about George Bush, John Kerry, and the U.S. economy. You can join the conversation tonight. What should the next president do to bolster that economy? Do you blame Bush for the massive deficit? Would either candidate fix it? And are you resonating to George Bush's ownership society or to John Kerry's commitment to the legacy of the New Deal? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking tonight with economists Alan Blinder in Princeton, New Jersey, and Charles Calamaris joining us from Rome tonight. We're also going to be checking in right across the country with different sectors of the economy tonight. I want to begin to do that right now with a look at Silicon Valley. David Lazarus joins us from San Francisco. He's business columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. David Lazarus, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Give us a quick snapshot of how Silicon Valley's looked at these last 4 years, how they look at George Bush and John Kerry standing off right now.
Well, the Silicon Valley recovery is lagging much of the recovery that we've seen elsewhere in the country. The economists who've been on the show have been talking about how it's been a bumpy ride over the last 4 years, and that's been more so here because Silicon Valley had steeper to fall after the dot-com meltdown took its toll. The place is just it got devastated on the employment front, and right now the unemployment rate is well above the national average from San Francisco down to San Jose, comprising the bulk of Silicon Valley. People at the moment are still saying that if there is a recovery, it's a very slow one, and it's not anywhere to be seen. For instance, Intel came out just yesterday and said that earnings are great, but hey, we see slow PC sales on the horizon, so don't get your hopes up. And I think that really speaks to the whole drumbeat of Silicon Valley, which is, yeah, we're taking it quarter by quarter, but no one is really counting their silicon yet.
So how's that translating, David, into politics in Silicon Valley, into presidential support one way or another?
Well, this is the Bay Area, so I think it's a fairly safe bet that Kerry is going to take the lion's share of the support around here, but that's not to say there aren't pockets of Republican resistance. For instance, John Chambers, the head of Cisco Systems, is a very active Republican fundraiser. There have been a number of Republican fundraisers, but it's not like President Bush has made a habit of coming out here and trying to court the vote regularly. He knows that California isn't going to go his way, and by the same token, Kerry doesn't really come out here that often because he knows he's got California in his pocket.
A huge tax bonanza for Silicon Valley and many other manufacturers this week with the passage of the, $140 billion tax break bill on Capitol Hill. Does Silicon Valley chalk that up in the Republicans' column as a gift from the GOP or not?
I think that's viewed as pretty much a gimme from Washington and not so much a gift from the Republicans. The Silicon Valley crowd has been very active in lobbying for their causes. For instance, the expensing of stock options, which is something that most Silicon Valley firms do not want because it would hammer their bottom lines. A number of firms here played a very active role in lobbying on this so-called jobs creation bill. Very high among them is Oracle, one of our leading software companies, and they were very active in pushing on the repatriation of funds side of this, which would be that if you brought back money that you have stashed overseas and bring it back, the tax rate on it would be substantially reduced on a one-off basis than it normally would. Well, Oracle Corp, it doesn't look like they're going to be building a lot of jobs with that. In reality, it looks like they're going to be funneling a lot of that money into their hostile takeover of PeopleSoft.
And David, a final question. Of course, it's Democratic-leaning. It's the Bay Area. But when you hear employees, managers in Silicon Valley talk about these two candidates and talk about, let's say, John Kerry. Do they, if they're for him, are they for him because they think he would improve the economy, or is it on other issues, not the economy?
I think predominantly a vote for Kerry is a vote against Bush. Quite simply, the level of anger towards President Bush is very strong here. There's a lot of resentment about Iraq. Some of the largest anti-war marches anywhere in the country took place right here. And so I don't know if it's so much that people have faith that Kerry is the guy who is going to solve all our economic woes. For instance, if you look at his plan to cut the deficit in half, which is essentially the same as Bush's plan to cut the deficit in half, it doesn't really hold water. There is no there. If you look at how it pencils out, especially with the baby boomers preparing to retire, it's clear that we're not really looking at a feasible plan to bring this number down. I don't think a lot of people in the Bay Area or Silicon Valley specifically see a Kerry administration as being friendlier as much as they look at the Bush administration and think, well, what have you really done for us? And the answer there is not a whole lot.
David Lazarus, you're terrific. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
A pleasure.
David Lazarus, business columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. Let me turn back to our two economists. And first, Charles Calamiris, to you in Rome, if I may. We've talked a little bit about your view of what George Bush has done. Look ahead with us. We're going to hear more about this in the debates tonight. We've heard about it on the campaign trail. What do you see George Bush doing with the U.S. economy in a second term?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because you're not going to hear much about the topic I want to talk about from either candidate tonight. And that is what we're going to do to get our long-term problem of unfunded entitlements under control. I really want to emphasize this because you talked about earlier in the program where we are with the deficit.
Mm-hmm.
I want to describe that problem, but before I do, my answer to your question is I think we're much more likely to see some beginnings of a solution to that problem from a second Bush administration than we are from a Kerry administration.
Why?
And first of all, John Kerry has claimed several times, most recently in the last debate, that he, quote, solved the Medicare problem. I believe he said it was in 1997. Well, of course, that's just, how shall I put it, a lie. We right now have a hole, an unfilled hole in Medicare alone of $50 trillion. To put that that number in perspective, we have an economy, an annual GDP of $10 trillion roughly. So we have this amazing hole. The prescription drug benefit, which the president signed, added 13 of that $50 trillion just recently.
So what's the president done about it? What would he do about it?
Well, unfortunately,
the deficit's gotten much bigger under George Bush.
Exactly. The deficit, though, I really want to emphasize here, is not the number that I'm worried about. I think that the candidates like to talk about the deficit because they don't like to talk about the real number that's a problem, and that
right.
is that $50 trillion.
That giant iceberg out there.
Exactly. And I think the difference is that John Kerry has told us that there is no problem. George Bush is telling us that, yes, there is a problem, and it's a difficult one to solve. So I think the difference is George Bush, I know from talking to his advisors, is very aware of this problem. And I think in a second term would have every incentive to do something about it. John Kerry's already lied to us and told us that there is no problem. And I think that from my perspective, this is a very, very big issue. And I'm very hopeful that Bush would do something to get us on the right track.
I want to turn to Alan Blinder for a second. Alan Blinder, we've got a real political economy going on tonight, but I guess that's inevitable in a campaign season. I'll put the same question to you, and you'll no doubt pick up on the deficit issue as well. But what would John Kerry do in his 4 years that you think would put America in a better situation economically?
First of all, there's a variety of things that he'd like to do in the short run to get the job engine turned over, coming back to the previous. We've done a very, very poor job of creating jobs in America. And, of course, it's not only George Bush, but he's contributed to it by a very poorly targeted tax program, for example. One of the things Kerry would like to do is a jobs credit. Another one is to bring down health insurance premiums for the private sector, which has been an impediment to job creation. But I want to come to the budget deficits, because unlike Charles, I do worry about the budget deficit. You know,
$415 billion in the fiscal year that ended this week, I think.
That's right. And, you know, that's sort of just the beginning. It's going to fall in the near term. But as you look further out, and this is another way to look at this Social Security, Medicare problem, we have a structural problem of immense dimension. Now, if you find yourself in a hole like that, according to an old piece of folk wisdom, the first thing you should do is stop digging.
Mm.
So I think that really is the first thing we need to do. We need to get this budget under control. The last time we had a prayer of actually chipping away at this gigantic long-run actuarial problem was 4 years ago in the election, just before George Bush became president of the United States. We were staring then at very substantial budget surpluses. And if you remember, this is a dim recollection now, Al Gore was pledging to use some of that money to fill the Social Security deficit.
Yes.
It wasn't a 100% solution, but it was a step in the right direction. Now, of course, we're in quite the opposite position. We have a current budget deficit and no hope in the near term of getting back a surplus.
So, but both candidates are looking at the, are claiming they'll cut it in half in their first term. They're both looking at the other and saying there's no way you'll do that. You've heard George Bush. He looks at John Kerry's health care plan and the rest and says, here we go. Big liberal spending is going to drive us over a cliff. John Kerry returns something like the same, and we'll ask about that.
Yep.
But what about it? Nobody believes John Kerry's going to balance the budget, do they? Do you?
No, he hasn't said he would balance the budget. It's about halving the deficit.
Now, even halving it, do you buy that?
Sure. And let me tell you a couple of things that are very important.
Okay.
Under George Bush, the first George Bush, Bush 41, as he's now getting called, we, that is the administration and the Congress together, put in budget enforcement rules to try to act against the deficits that we had been running for a decade or so. Two things were important: caps on so-called discretionary spending, and especially important was the pay-as-you-go principle.
Mm-hmm.
The way you want to think of the pay-as-you-go principle is that any under pay-as-you-go, anybody proposing new spending or a tax cut had to also propose a way to spend, pay for it. That was a huge deterrent, and it really helped immensely in getting the budget under control.
What happened to that?
Yeah, one of the first things the Bush II, Bush 43 administration did is drop those rules.
Secretary of Treasury O'Neill said, Dick Cheney told George Bush, and he heard it, deficits don't matter.
Yeah, exactly. Now, if they don't matter, you can drop the rules. Who cares what the deficit is? But John Kerry doesn't believe that, and he's pledged to bring back the budget enforcement rules of Bush 1 instead of the policies of Bush 2. He's also done another thing, which I think is very extraordinary for a candidate. I can't remember this ever done in a campaign before. Kerry has said repeatedly now that if, in fact, the numbers are not coming in as well as he thought they would, revenues coming in lower or spending's coming in higher or something, he will actually pare back his programs to meet the deficit target.
Well, there's a promise. I want to get Charles Calaveras your response, but callers want to join us. We've got more people to talk to here. Let's begin to invite them in. Don is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
You
I
bet.
Appreciate it.
Sure.
Actually, I was on hold while I heard Charles' comments. So before I comment on my initial, to address my initial call, I wanted to take exception with his comments. He characterized Mr. Kerry as a liar, and I find that hard to believe. He self-admittedly proclaimed that he speaks to Mr. Bush's advisors. Those might be the same advisors that has promised 6 million new jobs when we're looking at a net loss for the first time since 70 years. And I would, to address the preface of the premise of the conversation tonight, whether we prefer ownership or a New Deal, I would contend that the New Deal got us out of a Republican depression, put millions of people to work, doing wonderful things like public works, TVA, all sorts of wonderful things. And then, of course, it took Democrats again to come out of the Bush 1 recession.
But Don, we're hearing tonight from Greg Ip at the Wall Street Journal and from Charles, certainly. They're saying, hey, we're out of the woods here in many dimensions. You've got a vigorous, a solid expansion going on. What's your problem with that, Don?
Well, you know, I'm not an economist. I'm a kitchen table citizen trying to make ends meet, and I see people being laid off. I come from a generation, the son of a generation, where people work for companies for throughout their lives. Now most people have multiple jobs. Real wages are going down. I think Greg initiated the conversation tonight describing the economy, and nothing was mentioned about real living wages, which have gone down for the average American for the last 25 years.
Don, we've got it. Let me put it to the Bush rep here tonight, and thanks very much for your call. Charles Calaveras, you know this clamor about wages and jobs. Paint the growth as you will. You've got a lot of people saying, look, I'm just not doing as well as I was, and I don't see how it's going to happen, and I'm afraid if I lose my job, I'm not going to get a different one. I'm not persuaded by this lack of job production, and where's the real wage growth?
Well, first of all, I'm very sympathetic to the argument that in some sectors and in some places in the United States, there has been substantial job loss. I mean, manufacturing as a sector has seen about 3 million jobs lost, and this has been certainly very hard, particularly in some regions of the country. So I didn't mean to minimize that. But at the same time, there's been job creation in other sectors, and within the manufacturing sector recently, there's been quite a spurt. There's been productivity growth in manufacturing, which I mentioned earlier, tends to create more of a lag in bringing job growth back. But there's also
you're
been
saying
a lot
just
of,
hold tight and wait, it'll all work out.
Well, not necessarily. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not obvious that manufacturing jobs are ever going to become as large a share of the economy as they were 5 years ago.
Charles Cullen, hold that thought if you would. We've got a guest on the line who can speak to that from Canton, Ohio. William Belden joins us. He's chairman and CEO of the Belden Brick Company. He's a member of the board of directors of the National Association of Manufacturers. William Belden, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Happy to be here.
So Belden Brick Company, founded 1885, 7 plants in Ohio. And how are you doing? How does the economy look from your vantage, Mr. Belden?
Our company has had a very busy last 2 years. Of course, being in the brick business, we're tied to construction, both residential and commercial / architectural. Our activity, our manufacturing activity, and our shipments have been at a very high level in the last couple of years.
And let me ask you, how about your bottom line and how about your workers' wages?
That's where things change a little bit. The bottom line, some of that growth in at the top line has not gotten to the bottom line for a host of cost factors that all manufacturers face. But the most significant for us, over and above the usual ones, is that in making brick, energy, specifically natural gas, is a major component of that. And so our margins have been squeezed badly by the tremendous increase in natural gas costs.
And wages, are they going up or
wages,
steady? Or?
The wages of our employees have gone up some.
It doesn't sound too robust.
3 to 4% range.
Mr. Belden, we've just got a minute left, and I know I'm going to lose you at the break, so let me just ask you straight up then. Who are you supporting for president, and why in economic terms?
I'm supporting the president. Some of the things that Charles was talking about relating to manufacturing, I think the manufacturing sector is extremely important for our whole country, and of course we're in part of that. We need to compete in the world marketplace. We need people who recognize the importance of manufacturing and the burdens that manufacturing operates under right now, and who will help us along those lines as we go further into the 21st century.
So that sounds to me, I'm hearing less regulation and maybe more drilling for energy in the U.S. under a George Bush.
That's correct.
Bill Belden, we're out of time in this segment, but thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
William Belden, Chairman and CEO of the Belden Brick Company in Ohio. We're talking about Bush, Kerry, and the U.S. economy. Who is more likely to rev up the American economic engine? And what about those tax cuts? Was George Bush right to make them? Will John Kerry's revision work? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Bush, Kerry, and the U.S. economy. You can join us tonight. We ask the Gipper's immortal question, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Is the country? And when you vote, will it be about the economy? On that score, who's got your vote and why? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight by two economists, a top economist, Alan Blinder at Princeton University, Charles Calamaris of Columbia joining us tonight from Rome. And right now, David is calling from Westwood, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you tonight?
Great, thanks.
Well, I'm a real Robert Rubin fan.
Okay, so you're a 90s economy guy.
Well, I did very well in the 90s for a lot of reasons, but I think primarily because Clinton and Rubin kept interest rates so low, and it did very well in real estate, and it allowed me to start my own business. I have 4 employees now. And the biggest obstacle for my doing better is health care costs, so I'm counting on Kerry to do something about that. But the thing that the point I really wanted to make tonight is that I hope that Kerry and the Democrats, once they get into office, stop just resting on their laurels as the protectors of the New Deal.
Yeah.
I feel they've got to go much further and rest, take this ownership rhetoric away from the Republicans, because I don't think the Republicans really mean it. It's a meaningless thing coming from them. It's just an excuse to give more money to the richest people. But I'd like to see the Democrats come up with a real ownership program.
And what would that mean to you? You mean more privatization of Social Security? What, David?
No. You know, giving people early in their life some real money, you know? I'd like to see them bring back the estate tax, and instead of putting that money into the government coffers, take that money and, you know, give it to young people at the beginning of their lives so they could buy a house or get an advanced degree or start a business.
And they have the means and a stake.
Yeah. And because the Republicans, I think, they've seen that this stakeholder language that's coming out of Professor Ackerman at Yale is a real winner for the Democrats. And they're trying to co-opt that language and make it meaningless before the Democrats catch on and make it real.
David, we've got it. And thanks very much for your call. Alan Blinder, let me come first to you on this. George Bush is very tough on the Democrats, on John Kerry on this front. He says that we have old institutions here that just aren't in tune with 21st century requirements, that it's time to create this ownership society. David says he doesn't believe that George Bush will actually do it, but he agrees that some kind of something along those lines needs to be done. John Kerry has identified more with New Deal commitments of the government to the people. How do you read those two perspectives on the economy in the future?
Well, first of all, I think some of these old programs are good programs. I think the Social Security program is probably the most successful socioeconomic program we ever enacted.
Well, fair enough, but
in this country.
2008, the first boomers turned 62. That is the year they begin collecting Social Security, and there's not enough money in there over the decades to pay it.
That's exactly right, and the first step in solving that problem is to get the budget back into some decent kind of shape. For example, the caller that was just on the phone was suggesting what I think is a very clever idea, to give a stake to you basically give it to the children, though they can't use it until they're age 18 or 21 or something like that.
I don't
that.
Hear John Kerry proposing that.
No. The problem with that is we don't have any money to give away anymore. If we were back in the year 2000, in fact, back in the Gore campaign, we were toying with ideas like that, because there was money to give away. There's nothing in the till. The till is worse than empty. So before we can think about things like this, and I think that is a creative thought, we have to refill the till. And the way, by the way, to create an ownership society, if that's going to have any meaning at all, is, again, I think the caller was right on point here. Ordinary people have to be able to get jobs and earn decent wages. Then they can save something. You know, this is not a socialized economy. This is a very private market economy. You can buy anything, but you have to have money.
You got to have some money. Charles Calamiris, our caller, says, hey, I'm all for the ownership society, but I don't believe that George Bush and the GOP is going to really deal everybody in on that. You hear the skepticism there.
Well, I'd like to comment on that. First of all, this past month, September, the Fed released its data showing that that U.S. household sector net worth reached a record of about $46 trillion.
But exactly, the inequality in that wealth is greater than since the robber baron days.
Well, right. You know, I'm not sure that's true. In fact, as an economic historian, I know that it isn't true.
Well you put a date on it then. It's the greatest since when, please, Charles Calamiris?
Well,
put a date on it if it's not the robber baron days. When? When has the American distribution of wealth been as unequal as it is today?
Well, I'm sorry.
I'd rather. What era? You're saying
what measure of inequality do you have in mind?
Well, I can't follow you down the narrow economist trail.
Could I make some comments that may be helpful in that regard?
Please, yeah.
Okay. First of all, home ownership in the U.S. is right now at an all-time high of 70% of U.S. families. I believe I heard a statistic. I'm not sure it's true. I heard a statistic that for people below the poverty line, which seemed almost unbelievable to me, home ownership rates were at roughly 50%. Stock ownership as a percentage of the total population is also at an all-time high, that roughly 53 million U.S. households, I believe, are stock-owning households.
So you're making the case that under George Bush, Americans have been put in a position where they're ready to get a foothold and go and room off as capitalists.
Well, no, I don't think I said that. You're putting words in my mouth.
No, but
what I'm trying to say is that If you look at some measures, for example, again, comparing to 1995 or 1996, which I think is a reasonable comparison from a business cycle standpoint, the percentage of households and the number of households that are stock owners has gone up dramatically from less than 41 million in 1995 to 53 million today. If you look at home ownership rates, they're much higher.
We got it.
Even so I don't think – I don't have a measure that I didn't bring with me tonight, a measure of the changing inequality that's occurring in America. But I think the point is to say that it's all just at the very top, that record $46 trillion of household net worth is only enjoyed by the very top of society, just isn't true. But I'd like to come back because, Tom, you promised I'd have a chance to respond, and Alan has made twice some comments about the deficit, so I think I should say a little bit about
Please
that.
Please go straight to it.
Well, first of all, I don't think the president and certainly none of his advisors have said that deficits do not matter. What they've said is that they had to make some tough choices, particularly with respect to Homeland Security spending in the first administration.
Well, Dick Cheney was quoted as saying that, but we'll leave that aside.
No, I said the president and his economic advisors. I don't know what the vice president said. But you may be right that he said that. But I think what's more important is what is the president saying the answer to the deficit is. What he's saying is slowing spending. That is, many of us were disappointed with the rate of spending, even in Homeland Security. We thought it was a little too high.
He said he'll deeply cut domestic spending programs, but he hasn't said which ones.
Well, let me try to finish my thought, if I could. That the president is telling us that the way we're going to get back on track in terms of the deficit, and remember that U.S. Government debt held by the public is still at a pretty low level, 35% of GDP. It's not like we're in the middle of a crisis where a little bit more debt is going to cause us to fall off some cliff. The problem is you have to bring the problem to a solution. He's telling us the way to do that is not by raising taxes, but rather by cutting spending. And I think that's a key difference between the two candidates. But I want to emphasize that even though the president does care about deficits and is focusing on them, that both candidates need to talk much more about Medicare. Social Security, which Alan mentioned before, only has, only a $7 trillion hole.
Yep.
Medicare has a $50 trillion hole. And the Kerry, as I said before, John Kerry has told us that problem has been solved. That's just not true.
I'm not sure that's exactly the language. I want to get one more guest in here. We'll come back to each of you. Stand by, Alan Blinder. Joining us from New York, Matt Goldstein is a senior writer at TheStreet.com. Matt, I hope we can look to you to give us a sense of how Wall Street is looking at the economy's performance under President Bush and how they're looking at the November 2nd election.
Hi, good evening. Well, first of all, I think if you're talking about Wall Street in terms of brokerage firms, there's no doubt that they're clearly rooting for the president to win. All you have to do is look at the campaign contributions. The lion's share has gone to the Republicans and the Bush administration. Some of the president's biggest contributors are Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, and Goldman Sachs. While some of those firms, of course, also give to John Kerry, by no means the same amount. And I think you have to trace a lot of it back to tax policy. There's a lot of support for the president's tax policy, particularly the cut on dividends, which probably would be in jeopardy if Kerry was to win.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Kerry's talk about rolling back the tax cuts and tax breaks for the upper income is something that hits hard on Wall Street. And even you just see this recent tax cut that's going to be passed in terms of corporate business.
So, Matt, let me ask you, it means Wall Street is happy with President Bush's tax policy. Does it also mean they're confident in his overall economic policy, that it's going to bring growth to keep the market doing well?
Well, I don't think that is necessarily the case. There was a lot of debate earlier in the year that if you looked at the market, if they thought Bush was going to win, the market would go up, and if Kerry was going to win, the market would go down. There's been contradictory measures there. People don't necessarily invest the same way they may benefit in their pocketbook and how they think about in terms of more economic issues. I think there definitely is a lot of concern on Wall Street about which direction the economy is going. And I think that's one reason why you've seen the market sort of basically flatline for most of the year. And I think there's also why I've heard the discussion about the deficit.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't heard either of the candidates really have not addressed it. And that's something that's clearly lurking in the background. And these are concerns that, you know, Wall Street will have no matter who is president.
So pro-Bush, but not exactly sending up fireworks yet. Matt Goldstein, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Matt Goldstein, senior writer at TheStreet.com. Sam is calling from Morgantown, West Virginia. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening, my friend. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, you say Dick Cheney says deficits are no problem. And I think when you try to look at the real differences between these candidates, they're both going to have to deal with the deficit. They both want to talk about reducing it, but the way in which they reduce it is really, I think, where you can find the rub, the difference. I think, you know, I come from West Virginia, so I'm familiar with the coal industry. I know, you know, you look, for instance, at the way the Bush administration has appointed basically, you know, coal lobbyists to run the Mine Safety and Health Administration. Their policy is do away with regulations. The Workers' Health and Safety Administrations are a waste of money. You know, there's where you're going to see the reductions from the George Bush side. And whereas Kerry, I think, might have a more even-handed and sort of worker-friendly approach to that. Anyhow, I'd like to hear an economist defend the sort of the star of the beast, reduce these vital, really vital social programs. I like to hear an economist defend that if they can. You can't chalk these things up to externalities. The Bush administration tries to pretend the black lung disease, which is on the rise, they're trying to reduce the dust standards for coal mines. This is just make-believe stuff. These are real problems that exist.
Sam, we've got it. Your phone line's breaking up and our time is short, but thank you so much for that call. Alan Blinder, I've got to turn to you here, I guess. Sam, not happy about what he sees from the GOP on the regulation side,
right,
from the coal miners' point of view.
Yep.
You've also heard a fair bit from Charles Calamiris here saying John Kerry has said that the unfunded mandates, the Medicare and Social Security problems, don't matter. They'll be solved. How would a Kerry administration begin to look at those?
First of all, he didn't say anything like that. They don't matter or won't be solved. And as I've said, you have to get the budget under control. Let me give you one really, to me, very striking number. This is a fact. That small piece that Charles was talking about of the big hole, that Social Security, is one-third the size of the Bush tax cut. Let me repeat that. That means that if we had cut taxes by one-third less, done two-thirds of the Bush tax cut, which, by the way, isn't so far from what Kerry proposes, though it's not exactly that, we would have had enough money to fill at least the Social Security part of the hole.
And what about that $50 trillion in Medicare obligation?
The truth is nobody has a clue. And by the way, it's not only Bush and Kerry. It's me and Charles and every expert you can think of doesn't have a clue how we're going to fill that gigantic hole.
Charles Calamiris, it looks like the last word may go to you tonight. You hear the tension in this conversation. On the one hand, so we've got some growth and wealth created. On the other hand, those missing robust job creation and real wage rise, it really gives people pause when they look at your candidate.
Well, I've tried to address that question by pointing out all the reasons why I think that the wage situation, the job situation is getting better, and based on where we are, I think is quite robust. But I guess the closing point I'd like to end with is just to say that increasing marginal tax rates is going to have a very negative effect on economic growth.
On households over 200,000, you mean? Curious.
Not just on households. I'm talking about small businesses. And I would also say, you know, Alan's own colleague, Harvey Rosen at Princeton, of course, has done some very good research on the very negative effects of increasing marginal tax rates on small businesses and job creation from them. And I think the president's on target there. So we definitely have some tough choices. Without trying to be partisan, I would just say I think the real question is, are either of the candidates going to address that gaping $57 trillion hole?
Voters will be watching
with
that.
Security.
We're out of time. Charles Calamiris in Rome tonight from Columbia University. Thank you so much for being with us. Great to have you.
Thank you.
And Alan Blinder at Princeton University. Wonderful to have you, Alan. Thanks so much for being on board.
My pleasure, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.